You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 17th of September 2018 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily, in association with UBS. Live from Adore House in London, this is the Monocle Daily. I'm Paul Osborne. Coming up, amid warnings of an imminent humanitarian catastrophe, Russia and Turkey agree to a buffer zone between government forces and rebels in Syria. We'll ask why and whether it's likely to hold. Brett Kavanaugh's meant to be days away from confirmation as a Supreme Court justice, but even some Republicans say that can't happen after sexual assault allegations emerged. We'll get the latest from the US. The political turmoil continues in Toronto, where an all-night sitting has brought controversial reforms a step closer. Later on, we'll speak to the Italian architect who's being celebrated in London, and we'll hear about a major brand at London Fashion Week.
It wasn't flooded with checks. And that is something that Bailey has grappled with over the years, is how much to use the Burberry check, which is obviously iconic. You know, he wanted to move it forward.
All that, plus the biggest stories from Asia, coming up in the next hour on the Monocle Daily, live from London on Monocle 24. Hello, welcome to the Monocle Daily. 10 days ago, a summit between Russia, Turkey and Iran failed to make any progress towards halting the threatened offensive to retake Syria's last rebel-held district. Today, though, it seems, the leaders of Russia and Turkey have had more success. They've agreed the creation of a demilitarized buffer zone in Idlib. But will that stop an assault that the UN has warned could create a humanitarian catastrophe? Well, for more, I'm joined by Henry Foy, Moscow bureau chief of the Financial Times. Henry, Vladimir Putin and Tayyip Erdogan meeting for 4 hours earlier in Sochi. What is it that they've agreed?
Quite, yeah. These are mammoth talks and seen really as last-ditch talks, the last chance by Erdogan, Mr. Erdogan, to convince Mr. Putin that the Russian military and the Russian military in support of the Syrian army should not launch an assault on Idlib to drive out really the last major bastion of rebel and quite extreme terror groups that have holed up there. What they've agreed is still to be really worked out, I think, but the general terms of it are a 15 to 20 kilometer wide strip of demilitarized zone in Idlib, cleared of weapons, cleared of heavy artillery, and cleared of these terror groups, which would allow a space for civilians to live in peace. There will be no shelling of that. There will be no airstrikes upon that. And the Russian and Turkish forces together would protect that.
It seems like a significant turnaround for Russia, considering Russia's foreign minister only a few days ago, a couple of weeks ago, was talking about the need to wipe out terrorists in Idlib.
That's correct. Mr. Putin was clear that he does still think that is necessary. But essentially what he's done is he said, OK, I'm going to give Mr. Erdogan 4 weeks, roughly 4 weeks till October the 15th, to make this plan work. And if you like, Russia said, we're not going to push ahead with what we believe, but we're going to really put the responsibility on the Turks, on Mr. Erdogan, to keep his word. Essentially, if he fails to create this corridor, if he cannot convince the terror groups to move out of that corridor and stop the attacks that are being that Russia says are being launched from there, then we'll have no choice but to launch the assault that we said we should have done in the first place.
Which would presumably harm relations with the Turkish leader, who is principally concerned about the influx of more refugees if there is an offensive.
Correct. I mean, Mr. Erdogan's he has two major aims here. One is to stop more refugees flooding into southern Turkey. It looks like the UN say roughly 700,000 may well be expected if the assault did take place. That's going to put a huge burden on the Turkish state, which is already under pressure. Now, the second thing is that he needs to defend some of these groups that Turkey's been supporting for almost the entirety of the seven-year war in Syria. These are a hodgepodge of groups, some under larger banners, some very, very extreme, some not so much more moderate opposition. Mr. Erdogan has some kind of allegiance to those and needs to make sure that those are protected. He doesn't want to see them wiped out by Russian airstrikes. At the same time, he has a relationship with Mr. Putin that has survived the fact that the two of them are on different sides in this conflict and backing different horses, if you like. The question, though, is how they can make this one stick. And at what we saw from Sochi did seem to suggest that some kind of personal chemistry and some kind of trust between them has been enough to get this over the line.
And that's important, isn't it? Because on a wider level, Russia is courting Turkey at the moment, is trying to pull it more in Moscow's direction and exploit the differences that have emerged between Ankara and Washington.
Correct. I mean, Russia has played a very weak hand incredibly well, across the Middle East in recent years. It's become the preeminent geopolitical power calling the shots in Syria. 3 years ago, it entered the war on the side of Mr. Bashar al-Assad's government and really shifted the war in his favor. So that gives it a real stronghold there. It's got very good relations with Israel, very good relations with Iran. It's got fantastic relations with Kurdistan, where it's basically funding that regional state. So it has a lot of spinning plates, not least add to that the fact that it's really Saudi Arabia's main partner on this current oil supply deal that is keeping the oil price at a decent level. So it needs all the friends it can get. It doesn't want to upset Ankara for no reason. On top of that, let's remember both countries are under pressure from the Americans. Trade wars and sanctions on both. Russia needs friends. It needs trade allies. It needs investment partners. And it's selling a lot of gas to Turkey and looking to sell more. It's building nuclear power plants there, and it's trying to increase trade. So basically, for the sake of another month, I think this is a pretty good deal for Mr. Putin to have struck.
You say for the sake of another month. I mean, could it be that inadvertently Russia's need for international friends, its desire to court Turkey, could turn out to be the best thing that's happened for the hopes of avoiding this violent offensive in Idlib?
Yeah, I think that is true. Assuming that Mr. Erdogan can keep to his word that he made to Mr. Putin, we assume he made to Mr. Putin in the private talks, that he can control these terror groups. Moscow has been saying for weeks now that these groups based in Idlib are using Idlib as a base to attack Russian military sites, other infrastructure in Syria, and potentially exporting terror around the region. Now, I believe that if Mr. Putin thinks that Mr. Erdogan has broken that and not been able to convince these groups to move out of Idlib and to disperse, if you like, then I think that Russia will push ahead with what it had originally planned. I mean, there are daily attacks, the Russian Ministry of Defense say, on Russian sites and assets in Syria by groups based in Idlib.
These are two countries that have very different views of the conflict in Syria. It's hard, I think, for countries outside to understand how they've been able to reach an accommodation.
That's a very good point. I mean, I think as we reach the sort of end game, if you like, of the Syria conflict, I mean, this has been seven awfully bloody and disgracefully militaristic years of war. There are going to be more and more situations like this where strange bedfellows have to make decisions. I mean, we've already seen Russia and Iran start to get a little uneasy over what Israel would like to happen in southern Syria and some kind of a buffer zone there with no Iranian-backed militia in that zone. So Russia has essentially taken Israel's side there and said, OK, we agree there shouldn't be any Iranian-linked terror groups in the south. So that's upset Tehran, but they've managed to keep that going. I think Mr. Putin's going to find himself pulled in lots of different directions as this reaches some kind of an endgame. Of course, the major question is what happens to the government and what happens in a post-war setting to Mr. al-Assad. Now, that is going to be the real tricky one that makes all these other conflicts and difficulties and diplomatic twists seem quite small. On top of all that, Mr. Putin is fully aware that Russia cannot afford to rebuild Syria by itself. It needs international money, whether that's UN money, whether it's Western funds, whether it's Americans. It needs to find partners to help it rebuild the state while keeping its influence, if you like, over strategic assets of oil and gas industry. So Mr. Putin is fully aware of that, and I think a lot of the strategic thinking around decisions like this has that in the back of his mind.
It's also another reminder of the extent to which it's Russia and not the United States that is the driving force in the region.
Absolutely. And to your earlier point about Russia exploiting, if you like, tensions between Washington and Ankara, I think Mr. Putin recognizes in lots of areas around the world, not just the Middle East, there's an opportunity for Russia to make new friends, to exploit tensions between the Trump administration and previously steadfast allies. And we're seeing in Europe how Mr. Putin is, I think, having quite a good year this year, given that a lot of European countries are a little uneasy by some of the rhetoric coming out of Washington.
Henry Foy, the FT's bureau chief in Moscow, thank you very much for your time this evening. You're listening to Monocle 24. Now, there are mounting calls to delay a vote on Donald Trump's nominee to fill the vacant seat on the US Supreme Court. Brett Kavanaugh denies an allegation of sexual assault which dates back to the 1980s, but the woman who has made that claim has said she is willing to testify to senators. Well, for more now, we're joined by the journalist and columnist Lauren Duca. Lauren, first of all, tell us more about this allegation that's been made against Brett Kavanaugh.
Yeah, so we have a woman named Christine Ford. She has depicted in much detail an event of an attempted rape in which Kavanaugh, at a party that took place during high school with a friend present, pushed her into a room and tried to remove her clothes, covering her mouth while she attempted to scream. The letter that she wrote to Senator Dianne Feinstein is available publicly. I would encourage readers to listen to her account. I think that this is being completely scrambled in the public conversation. It's about, is high school too long ago? Do attempted rapes fall into a category of boys will be boys? And it's really particularly infuriating given the way this Supreme Court pick will affect rulings on women's bodies. And in the context of the Me Too movement, you know, we're not just talking about ramifications at a cultural level, but legal ones where this type of person who has now a clear history of disrespecting women's bodily autonomy would be ruling on them from the highest court in the land.
I mean, we should say that Brett Kavanaugh has denied these allegations in his public comments. The vote is scheduled for Thursday. It seems inconceivable that can go ahead because this is going to be hanging over him unquestionably by the end of the week.
Absolutely. I can't imagine how this could happen and continue to be a legitimate government, quite frankly, without a full and complete addressing of this issue. And the reality is there were so many elements to Kavanaugh before these allegations even came forward, which indicated that these hearings should have been delayed. There were issues of perjury, not having a full accounting of public records. In general, this has been shoved through by the Republican Party, and they are attempting to beat out the midterms for the hearings on Trump's SCOTUS nominee. And it's become uncivil to a degree that, frankly, has only escalated with these allegations. But there was a total lack of civility and absurdist lawmaking at play even before.
It's not just Democrats, though, on this occasion that are calling for a delay. There are Republicans who are concerned, too, which could make all the difference.
Yes. And what's amazing is that there still is Chuck Grassley, who is the head of the Senate Judiciary Committee, is saying that he's going to continue to go ahead with a vote. But I am relieved to see that there are now Republican senators who are taking a stand on this. It's we're having such a crisis here in the sense that, you know, our president has also had allegations of this sort. And this is just another extreme way for us to have as a country a conversation about the way in which we're able to treat women. And I think something that the way we treat women and the way women are, what women are meant to accept. What's amazing is also Clarence Thomas, which is another one of our justices, has been brought up, who, of course, weathered Anita Hill's allegations when he was confirmed however many decades ago. And the idea is, well, will they let that through? If the times have changed now, and I think we've entered a space in which American women and actually really women around the world in the context of far spread hatred and authoritarianism are fully realizing political agency. And I would say that while women maybe were angry at this sort of treatment before, what has changed is that we understand ourselves as political actors and we're not passively navigating a sexist system. We're actively seeking to change it. And there is so much anger and so much people power. And I know these senators are hearing from American citizens in record numbers. And I just hope that they listen to them.
Does this also perhaps raise the question of whether Supreme Court appointments really should be for life? There's no other country in the world that appoints judges to its highest court as a lifetime job.
Absolutely. I mean, especially given the context of the president that is making this nomination and everything that is coming into question with his legitimacy, I think I'm hoping that once we address, you know, this raging dumpster fire of Kavanaugh's nomination, hopefully it is delayed or blocked. But if that beyond that, we can have a broader conversation about court reform, the potential for impeaching justices, the potential for term limits. If I have an optimistic take on things right now, and certainly, you know, we're still kind of in the thick of it, it's that the American public has a more in-depth understanding of the way the court works, because we tend to think of especially the Supreme Court as some sanitized institution that is separate from our lives when it is dictating our lives and will dictate this nomination, if he is confirmed, will dictate American life for decades. I think that the American public has a better grasp on that and will be more tuned into that. So hopefully it opens the door for court reform down the line. Incremental change, I suppose.
Lauren Duca, thank you very much for your time. Still ahead on the Monocle Daily, architecture on display at a London gallery, the challenges that are facing the International Criminal Court. And in just a moment, we'll catch up on the latest political turmoil in Toronto.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Weighing in at almost 400 pages, the Monocle Guide to Cozy Homes is packed with everything you need to know about making a great place to live. The book is filled with handsome residences and all the contacts you need to make a home that will last a lifetime. And it's a book that celebrates the people who know homes should be able to cope with kids, dogs, and a few scuff marks too. It's a book that knows a home is only as good as the community it's in, and it's a book that takes you through the front doors of everything from mountain hideaways to modernist towers. So be cozy and buy your copy today at monocle.com.
Well, next to Toronto and the latest moves in the bitter political battle over the size of the city's council. After the Supreme Court blocked efforts to cut the number of councillors, Ontario's provincial leader Doug Ford announced plans to invoke a previously unused rule to override the courts. Well, now an all-night sitting's brought that legislation a step closer to becoming law. Nelson Wiseman is a professor of political science and is the director of the Canadian Studies Program at the University of Toronto and is on the line now. This legislative session, why did it have to begin at midnight?
Well, the government is eager to get this legislation passed because the election is scheduled for October 22nd. So there's all sort of preparations that have to be made by the city clerk. Are we going to have 25 districts or wards, as they're called, or are we going to have 47? You've got to set up the mechanics. You've got polling stations. voters have to know where they're voting and who the candidates are. The candidates don't know right now in which ward they're running. Are we going to have 47 or going to we have 25? The campaign started quite a while ago, so candidates assumed they were running with 47 wards, and they selected the wards they were going to run in. Now, all of a sudden, it's 25. So, you know, candidates who haven't been canvassing in certain areas now may be responsible for those areas. So it's very confusing. You've got to have ballots printed and all those sort of things.
Let's go back to the beginnings of this. Ford says that the people who elected him did it because they wanted fewer politicians. But many of those politicians say what he's actually doing is targeting constituencies that don't vote for him. So who do you think is right?
I don't think it's quite like that. He didn't run by saying people wanted fewer politicians. He said, I'm running to cut the size of government. That's quite different. In fact, the Ontario legislature, the legislature which he leads now, is larger now than it was before. So he could introduce legislation to cut the size of the legislature itself. He hasn't suggested he's going to do that. And I should say an earlier conservative premier did that. So Ford didn't mention at all during the election that he planned to cut the size of city council. And what he did was foolish because he introduced the legislation in the middle of a campaign. Now, as it turns out, that was held up by the courts. You said the Supreme Court, it's actually a lower level court, and the government, Ford's government, is appealing that decision. But who knows when a higher level court will rule on it. Tomorrow, the government is asking for a stay of the lower court's decision, which reversed the Ford's agenda for the city. If they're successful, then the initial legislation will come into effect. We'll only have 25 seats. But if they're not successful in the stay, they are determined to get this legislation through this week so that planning for the election municipally can proceed.
And the appearance of this to those outside the inner circle of Ontario politics, that it A, looks a little bit suspicious and slightly grubby, and B, seems to suggest that judicial decisions no longer matter.
Well, two things. It is grubby. It looks sleazy. If you recall, we had a very controversial mayor, Rob Ford, the younger brother of the current premier, Doug Ford. They were both on the city council, but our city councils do not work like legislatures. There's no responsible government, there's no cabinet. So the mayor is just one vote on that council. The council kept voting down proposals by the mayor and his brother, Doug. Doug, who is now the premier, was very upset with that. And now it appears like he's being vindictive. He's taking on the city council, now cutting the size of council. Some people think, oh, this is an effort so that you'll get fewer left-wingers and more right-wingers. But that isn't clear to me at all. All you're doing is essentially reducing the size of the council roughly by half. And it could be we might get more right-wingers, but it's possible we won't have any change. Ford claims that municipal government will be more efficient. There will be less gridlock with fewer councillors. But, you know, you can have gridlock with three councillors, with two councillors, or one councillor who's got mixed mind, can't decide one minute to the next. So the number of councillors isn't nearly as critical as the dynamics that go on in the council. And unlike parliaments, where parties are organized, our councillors are not organized along party lines. So you have voting, you know, so-called leftists will vote for something proposed by a rightist on one issue and not on another issue. And then you got a lot of people who are in that mushy center. So the dynamics of a council are very different than the dynamics of a Westminster-style legislature, as you have in London and as we have here in Ontario and in Ottawa.
Is there any indication in the midst of all these political arguments of what the voters actually make of it?
Well, I think the voters in Toronto, for the most part, are upset. That's what polling indicates. But I think outside of Toronto, most voters couldn't give a damn. I suspect they feel fine, stick it to Toronto. And I suspect there's a similar animus toward London in large parts of Britain, where, you know, the so-called elites of downtown, of the big city, are resented. And so that plays out in Ford's majority legislatively comes from the rural areas. Conservative parties are much stronger in rural areas, and that's the case in Canada, in Germany, in Britain, in France, and so on. So he can lord it over the city. And local democracy is relatively weak because under our constitution, which is written unlike your constitution, municipalities are completely under the thumb of the provincial government. So if Ford wanted to, if the province wanted to, it could decide to divide Toronto into two cities, into three cities. In fact, constitutionally, it could decide it just wants to appoint a supervisor and do away with elections completely. But I think that would really cause outrage.
It feels like this has got some way yet to go. Nelson Wiseman, thank you very much. In just a moment, we'll focus on the challenges that are facing the International Criminal Court. First, though, let's catch up with some of the day's other top news stories. Hopes are fading that survivors can be found after landslides triggered by a typhoon in the Philippines. More than 60 people are known to have been killed as Typhoon Mangkhut battered the country. At least 32 were killed in a single shelter after it was submerged. The storm's now weakened as it passes over southern China. The International Monetary Fund has warned a no-deal Brexit would leave the UK facing substantial costs. The IMF says all forms of Brexit would have a financial impact, but crashing out of the EU on World Trade Organization terms would be the most challenging. The warning comes as Britain's Prime Minister, Theresa May, insists in a TV interview that the only alternative to her proposed deal is to leave the EU without an agreement. And a court in Belgium is refusing to extradite a rapper who fled Spain after being convicted over controversial lyrics. Josep Miquel Arenas Beltran was found guilty of insulting Spain's monarchy and glorifying terrorism. Spain issued an EU arrest warrant after the rapper disappeared before starting a 3.5-year prison sentence, but a judge in Belgium has refused the extradition request, citing freedom of expression. This is the Monocle Daily. It's been a difficult few days for the International Criminal Court. The United States has never really been a fan, but one of Donald Trump's most hardline advisers has threatened to go after the court if it investigates alleged war crimes by American troops in Afghanistan. The court, though, continues its work, sentencing a former vice president of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Well, joining me now is Kevin Heller, a professor of criminal law at SOAS, University of London, and the author of a number of books on war crimes trials and international criminal law. Kevin, let's start with that sentencing of Jean-Pierre Bemba. He's been convicted of bribing witnesses during his war crimes trial. What's the court said?
Well, this comes obviously following a very high profile and very controversial acquittal of Bemba on the war crimes and crimes against humanity charges. So this is very much a fallback that basically says, as part of his defense at trial, they was busily, you know, bribing witnesses and suborning perjury. And so it's certainly not the same as convicting him of an international crime, but it's also not nothing.
Now, he, as a result, cannot run for president. What is he likely to do?
I think you probably have to ask him. You know, it's certainly, I'm sure, came as a shock that he was disqualified from standing for election. There's obviously a danger that, as a formal rebel leader, this will become he'll become a destabilizing element again in the DRC. We can certainly hope that that doesn't happen. I think we just have to wait and see.
Does this perhaps expose some of the problems of the ICC that, he, as you say, you know, acquitted in his war crimes trial, then accused of bribing witnesses in that trial, he can be given this sentence? He's not being put in jail, is he? He's going to probably get on a plane and go back. The court is capable of holding people to account up to a certain extent.
This is certainly not the high point of the ICC. defenders of the court like to say, oh, well, there has been 8 convictions, but of course there have been more convictions for obstructing justice than for actual international crimes, and that's not exactly, you know, covering the ICC in glory. But at the same time, you know, if in fact he was bribing witnesses, as seems to be the case, and if he was suborning perjury, it obviously, from a prosecutor's standpoint, becomes much harder to convict somebody when they are, in fact, obstructing justice. So I'm not sure that you can hold that against the court itself, but this is certainly not the outcome that anybody was hoping for.
Now, of course, the U.S. didn't sign up to the ICC. John Bolton, meanwhile, would like to see it wound up.
Well, John Bolton has been, you know, a traditional enemy of the ICC. He was really the architect of the hostility between the United States and the ICC during the Bush administration. And now that he has a much more sympathetic ear in Donald Trump, he's clearly back on the let's try to destroy the ICC bandwagon.
Well, his argument is what exactly? Because the U.S. soldiers couldn't be handed to the ICC. If the ICC decided to investigate and felt that there were grounds to bring charges against American soldiers, the U.S. would just refuse to hand them over.
Absolutely. I don't think anybody expects to see an American soldier, or probably more specifically, a CIA officer in the dock in The Hague anytime soon. But I think the U.S. is, you know, just fundamentally, philosophically, and politically opposed even to kind of any insinuation that an American could ever commit a war crime or a crime against humanity. So I'm sure that Bolton does not actually fear an American being prosecuted. He just wants to make it very clear that this is their line in the sand and the ICC should stay out of the U.S.'s business.
15 years after Abu Ghraib, it's an interesting argument for the Americans to make that their military personnel are incapable of committing abuses.
It is. And, you know, defenders of the U.S. and critics of the ICC like to point to this supposed long history of accountability for excesses during the war on terror. And if you actually look at what they've done, no one of any importance has ever been held to account for, particularly the torture regime under the Bush administration. And so I think, again, they're not particularly worried about the soldiers as much as the CIA officers in the black sites in Eastern Europe, who are very much, you know, kind of up to their ears in, you know, criminal responsibility for torture. And then all of the supervisors and the superiors who gave them their orders and tolerated the international crimes.
You mentioned that the ICC's record on convictions isn't necessarily stellar. I mean, how would you rate the court's performance?
I mean, I don't think one can give it a very high mark. Again, if you ask someone who defends the court more fervently than I do, they'll say it's a young court, it's still growing, it takes time. That rings a little hollow to me. I mean, the court has been in operation now for 16 years. That's not that young. And it hasn't exactly had a very long track record of successes. And certainly it's not all the ICC's fault. The court is dependent upon the UN Security Council. It's dependent on the cooperation of states. And it has gotten support from neither most states nor the Security Council. But that's a problem if it can't solve. It's never going to have a more successful track record than it has to date.
If the ICC isn't the solution to dealing with international justice, what is?
I wouldn't say that the ICC doesn't have a role to play. I just think we need to temper our expectations for what it can actually accomplish. I mean, from my own perspective, you know, if you think about universal jurisdiction as a basis for, you know, national courts prosecuting international crimes with which they have no connection, to me, that's a much more vein of possibility. If you look now at accountability mechanisms in Syria, we hear endlessly about the International Criminal Court, yet as we speak, there have been at least 8 countries in Europe who are prosecuting war crimes and crimes against humanity in Syria via universal jurisdiction. We need more of those kinds of prosecutions from the United Kingdom, from Norway, from France, from Germany, and not to replace the ICC, but if we put all our eggs in the ICC basket, I think that's going to be inevitably disappointing and disenchanting.
Kevin Heller, thank you very much. You're listening to The Daily from Monocle 24. Next, we turn to London's Royal Academy of Arts, a home not just for artists, but for architects as well. A new retrospective there is focusing on the work of Italy's Renzo Piano, highlighting the work and the art that's gone into projects from the Pompidou Centre to the Shard. Monocle's Daphne Carnesa spoke to Piano at the opening, who told her he is still surprised every time he completes a project.
I get surprised myself. You know, it's not just me. Everybody gets surprised. I know many, many writers that are surprised about the phrase that they just made. You know, oh, that's me. Sometimes you're surprised. And this is starting very soon in life. You know, the first time, this is the first time for that. When you are 8 years old, 9, 10 years old, and for the first time in your life you do something that works, then you watch what you've done. And maybe a phrase, maybe a little song, or maybe a little object, and happily somebody around you, maybe your mother, your father, your brother, sister, comes and say, oh, well done. And then you are surprised about, that's me, I made this. I'm still like that now, still like that. I mean, you do things and then you are surprised. It's because, of course, it's not you, just you. You're surprised because you working with other people, you come up with something that makes sense. And this is the secret of teamwork. This is the secret of teamwork. I mean, this is something that is unique. And I think you needed that kind of innocence to keep. And somebody said that it takes a long time to become a child in life, and I think this is quite true.
How do you feel about London as a city? Obviously, you've got one of the most emblematic buildings of the city that you've designed right here.
So many buildings, what you prefer, what you know, it's difficult to say. I mean, when you look at those things, they are all children in some way, and it's difficult. You normally take more care of the youngest, so you are very close to the ones that are still going on, you know, but this is one of the problems, and that you have so many children around the world, and you are worried about their lives and if they are happy or not.
And you want to visit them as often as you can?
Yes, of course. I visit, I care. It's like children. You are worried. And you know, buildings like children are happy sometimes, sometimes not happy. Because buildings need love. Not just your love. And thanks God, when you make a public building, they become, almost ever, they become a place for people that people love, because they become part of their lives. So when you make a museum, a university, a school, a church or whatever, a library, those buildings enter in the kind of ritual of the city. And they become part of the life of people. So Beaubourg in Paris took a long time, but now it's part of Paris. It's part of the life of many people. And then that's why those buildings are normally more loved than private buildings, because they belong to the community.
And what about the value, in your opinion, of architectural exhibitions such as this one? I mean, obviously it's quite different from an art exhibition, but what do you think the value is, both for the people that come to see the exhibition, but also for the architects such as yourselves? Do you gain something out of it as well?
I was a bit surprised when we were offered to make an exhibition at the Royal Academy, because architecture is not really about art. It's more like construction and community and society. But this is not true, because in reality architecture is art as well. And of course it's about construction, it's about the poetry of construction, it's about community, because you make building for people, for community, to create a city, a better place to live. But you know, such kind of message, it's almost like watching in the iceberg, you know, not only the visible part of the iceberg, but also the invisible part of the iceberg. Without that invisible part, that is 9 times bigger than the visible part, you don't see the rest. So this is what is quite subtle in this exhibition, and that's why making this exhibition at the Royal Academy, in a museum that is about art, makes sense. Because, you know, at the end, you feel that You need art, you need poetry, you need beauty in some way to reach people emotionally.
And you're right, the exhibition really does make a lot of the artifacts that you made use of visible to us, you know, what's behind all your projects. And I noticed a lot of your hand-drawn sketches, which are, of course, instantly recognizable to many of us. Is it true that a lot of these are sketched as part of your meetings that you have in your studio, and then your colleagues quickly scan them, and then you kind of use those as a reference point?
Yes, but it's not my merit. If the exhibition does this miracle, it's because it's been well done by the Royal Academy, by the curator, by Kate Goodwin, by the other people, by people in my office. I mean, this work is a long work. I think we started 3 or 4 years ago, something like that. It takes time.
What's your day-to-day routine like now in your studio in Paris, for example? Do you have daily meetings with your team?
Life is very simple. I go, I don't know what I have to do. I go to the office, I step in the office. As soon as I cross the threshold, everybody comes to me. And this is what is so enjoyable about teamwork and an office like mine, is that you don't care. You go there and the dance starts. And you never stop up to when you go to home. And next morning you start again. So it's kind of, you know, teamwork is like that. I mean, you become part of, it's like a dance and never stopping dance.
And that's Renzo Piano speaking to Monocle's Daphne Karnisis at the opening of that retrospective of his work. It's on at the Royal Academy here in London until January 2019. You can hear more of that interview in this week's edition of Monocle on Design. It premieres tomorrow at 1900 London time, or any time after that at monocle.com. In just a moment, we'll take a look at some of the top stories across Asia.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
Well, it's time now to look at some of the top stories across Asia with my guest Bruno Garces. He is the BBC World Service's digital editor for East Asia and is with me in the studio. Let's begin, as we do so often, with the trade war between China and the United States, fears that more US tariffs are imminent.
Yeah, it's probably likely not to be the last time we'll be talking about this. Now it's Trump's top economic advisor, Larry Kudlow, saying that China is actually global trade's biggest culprit on the current trade wars between the US and China. And this is what most analysts are seeing as a possible sign that the U.S. is more than likely to bring up new tariffs against China worth up to quite a huge amount, actually, quite $200 billion.
Now, it's quite extraordinary, the continual escalation of this. I mean, it seemed worrying enough 2 or 3 months ago.
Yes, And I mean, I think China is playing a very careful hand in this supposed war, and which some are calling a new Cold War. But it might, if these measures are to be implemented by the U.S., it might lead to a retaliation by China, which has been a bit more timid in its response because it has a more measured approach. It believes that in the end, It might lose a few battles now, it might face some consequences now, but in the end it has a lot to gain as it owns a big chunk of U.S. debt.
Is that something that necessarily the White House has come to terms with or realized yet?
Well, this White House is not notorious for long-term planning or strategizing in the long run.
So, to put it mildly.
Yes. So probably not is the short answer.
Now, similar economic protectionism, it seems, could dominate elections in Indonesia.
Yes, well, it's being reported that both presidential contenders, the current incumbent President Jokowi Widodo and his rival Prabowo Subianto, are both adopting a very harsh nationalist stance, especially when it has to do with mineral resources in the country. And that's a popular stance with the voters. It might frighten foreign investors a little bit, but given what is at stake, that's a card both candidates are playing.
Do you think that is a reflection of the international mood? That there, we're talking about the US, obviously, that there is just this shift towards sort of economic nationalism now.
There's that. There's also the economic uncertainty in Indonesia itself, with the rupiah having fallen to levels that we hadn't seen in decades, I would say. So Jokowi, the current president, is trying his best. I wouldn't say it's survival because he's a popular leader, but he knows what is at stake, and some of his allies have already fallen from grace. That includes the Jakarta governor, who was his ally and was arrested, has gone to jail on accusations of offending Islam, which led to his very shrewd move of adopting a traditional Muslim leader as his candidate for vice presidency. So I think it has to do with that, and also being a popular stance in a big country with a growing market, with a fourth most popular country in the world, having huge resources in nickel and copper, natural gas. So there's a lot at stake, and it's a popular stance.
And it's a recognition that he's taking that re-election campaign seriously.
Oh, definitely. Most definitely so. And he knows that any false move could cost him his re-election, really.
Now, in India, reports picking up on a fashion show with a difference.
Oh, yes. This was a very interesting show aimed at not only having youngsters, children mainly, adolescents with disabilities, but also disabled people themselves designing some of the costumes and the outfits that were shown in this display. They were students from Tamana, School for Differently Abled Children, who walked the ramp and who designed some of the clothes seen there.
And what reaction from the audience?
Well, it was huge. It was very overwhelming, positive. And I think the interesting thing is, in a country where facilities for people with disabilities are somewhat rare, having this kind of thing, you know, luxurious brands, in a fancy hotel in Delhi, this was very indicative of a desire to embrace change and to open themselves to diversity, really.
Well, we've spoken before on this program about issues in India, particularly around what facilities, what help is available for people with different disabilities. And so it is, in a way, it's quite remarkable to see.
Yeah, I think it's a push forward. I mean, there are scarce facilities everywhere, unfortunately, and it's a country that, in terms of infrastructure overall, has serious limitations. What's more, for people with disabilities. So to have this kind of event in a luxurious hotel with top brands is indeed a landmark.
Now, finally, austerity measures in Pakistan. Nobody is exempted from this. Dozens of luxury cars being lined up to be sold.
Yes, it's a total of 102 luxurious and surplus vehicles that were originally kept at the Prime Minister House in Islamabad, and they're going on sale and that's part of an austerity campaign by the current Prime Minister and his party, the PTI. And it seeks to be an example. His predecessor, Imran Khan's predecessor, Nawaz Sharif, is currently arrested under accusations of corruption. So he wants to distinguish himself from previous holders of the leadership of Pakistan.
Eight BMWs among the cars being sold, four Mercedes, 16 Toyotas, a Lexus, some Land Cruisers, and a bus as well, also apparently being sold. I'm not sure why there's a prime ministerial bus. This is obviously all very admirable, but wasn't it also Pakistan's new prime minister who decided to commute to his office by helicopter?
Under the claim that he was doing that not to disrupt traffic too much. So
it's not as if, I mean, he clearly didn't have any cars he could have used.
Yes. So, I think what's clear to many is that there's a lot of showmanship in this. He wants to set the example, fine, but to what extent he's actually committed to full-fledged austerity, that's something else. And that's what time will tell us, how far Imran Khan is willing to go. Will he be a politician with a twist, with a completely different from his predecessors, or will he follow their steps in the end and then maybe even tarnish by the same accusations?
These are some nice cars, I've got to say. Five of them are bulletproof. These are reinforced. Land Cruiser went for 27 million. I mean, this has brought in a bit of cash. This is no eBay sale. This is no garage sale.
No, it's some profits there to be made. Now, what happens next is what we have to see. If this is just a display of something that the prime minister wants to show off as being his credentials to what he's claiming to be different, or if it's just an isolated thing, really.
Well, we'll wait and see. I mean, I feel like I've missed out on the opportunity to snap up a couple of bargains there. Bruno Garces, thank you very much. You're listening to Monocle 24. Well, that's nearly it for tonight. Before we head off, though, we turn our focus to here, further into the British capital. It is London Fashion Week. Earlier, all eyes were on the Burberry show, the first under their new chief creative officer. Our fashion editor, Jamie Waters, was there. Earlier, he spoke to Monocle's Kanata Rabello about it. They began by talking about Burberry's place at the moment as a brand.
Burberry is at a crossroads at the moment. Christopher Bailey was at the helm for 17 years and he left last season. And I think he had an amazing ride with the brand and he elevated it to kind of a luxury brand. But then in recent years, it plateaued. Their profits have plateaued. And then in the last few months, there's been quite a lot of controversy surrounding the brand. In July, these revelations came out about the fact that they were burning unsold clothes. It was to the tune of £26 million or something like that, which obviously caused a huge controversy. And they've since stopped that policy. They've also banned fur in the last couple of months as well. So they're now only using faux fur. So there's a lot of chatter surrounding the brand. They've had a lot of publicity, good and bad publicity. And then among all of that, Tichy has taken over. So it's an interesting kind of proposition when you take over a brand from someone that's been there for 17 years, because Burberry has become so synonymous with Christopher Bailey and his aesthetic. And so there's both that, and then there's also, it's a heritage house as well. So he's got these two sort of, there's Bailey's heritage and then there's Burberry's heritage as well. So yeah, I mean, I think he's kind of, I mean, it's a big challenge for him, but he has amazing, track record. At Givenchy, he, again, going into a heritage house, and he put his mark on that brand. And I think so, people were very excited to see what he would do at Burberry.
Well, it seems like it's an immense challenge that he took over. How do you think he has done so far? I know you've talked through some of the policy changes, particularly when it comes to that story about burning clothes, and now that they said they're not going to use fur anymore. But how do you think that she has done so far at Burberry?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I mean, Even so, the show has just happened, which we'll obviously talk about. But even in the lead up to the show, he's already stamped his mark on the brand. And I think what he is excellent at is marketing. He's a master marketer, and he's shown that in the lead up. So he changed the logo, he changed the monogram, he collaborated with the UK designer Peter Saville, and he's kind of stamped his mark on the brand. The font is now sans serif. So he's kind of done these things already. He's also got the monogram is TB for Thomas Burberry. And on social media, he's unveiled his first design in the last week, which is a T-shirt with the monogram, which is a hugely collectible thing. You know, there's already now buzz about that T-shirt. Various people have now, there's all these photos of various famous people wearing the T-shirt. And it's got that distinctive monogram. Like, he's very good at that. So already there's been a lot of talk about him and his changes at the brand before he sent the first design down the catwalk. So that is kind of already shows his, you know, a big part of his skill. So he's kind of, there's been a lot of buzz around the show.
The show just happened a couple of hours ago, and yeah. You were there. How was it like?
Yeah, so I mean, I've literally just come back. The atmosphere was absolutely electric. And I'll kind of just talk through the way it kind of unfolded, because it was interesting. So you kind of walked in and sat down, and it was all very dark. So everyone's sitting in darkness. You just kind of assumed it would be that these bright lights were going to come on at some point. In fact, what happened was they rolled back the shutters on the roof, and it's a very sunny day in London today. And so the place was just flooded with sunlight. So it was kind of like an amazing way to start. And then he divided the show into, I guess, four segments. So more formal women's and more formal men's, and then more casual women's and more casual men's, or perhaps, and the more formal, perhaps older, and then the younger stuff towards the end. So I think it was a really interesting mix of references to Burberry. There were a few references to the Czech, and there were a lot of, you know, trench coats and things like that, but not too many. It wasn't flooded with Czechs. And that is something that Bailey has grappled with over the years, is how much to use the Burberry Czech, which is obviously iconic. You know, he wanted to move it forward. So, and it's interesting how Tishy kind of, he did use it, but it wasn't kind of flooded. So his more formal designs, he had, there was a lot of leather, there were various trench coats in various forms, a lot of beige for the women's. So, you know, some quite classic designs, and then a lot of suiting for men. And then he moved into the younger, more casual designs for both men and women. And I found that really interesting. And that was kind of, that sort of recalled the sexy, sultry designs that he, you know, that he's kind of known for. And basically, you know, at Givenchy, what he did is he turned it into a sexy brand. And he was kind of known for this sort of like romanticism that is kind of dark and sultry. And he also, what he had done at Givenchy was, he was one of the early pioneers of putting streetwear into luxury. So sweatshirts, the images of bulldogs on a T-shirt, but it's a luxury brand. So, and that was kind of, you know, that he was one of the first to do that. And so here, again, you know, in these more casual section, there was a great bright red hoodie in the men's, which I think was worn over a beige trench coat. So it's kind of mixing the two different codes. There were this series of silver high heels for women, which I thought were great and very sellable. So there were definitely those designs that, you know, will sell, and that are kind of very distinctive, you know, especially with accessories, that you just feel like they will sell.
Well, do you feel then overall we're witnessing a new Burberry here?
Yeah, it's definitely a new Burberry. I mean, he's got a very different tone to bear. He's a very different sort of designer. They're both very distinctive. I mean, I think especially with the more casual designs, he kind of made his mark on the, you know, put his stamp on it, and it feels a bit younger. It does feel sexier, which is, I guess, what people were expecting, and a bit more street. And perhaps, I mean, I think they're probably trying to woo a younger customer, and I think this will probably do that. It did feel a bit younger, and as I say, you know, those streetwear references were sort of woven in. And I think even the way that he's going to sell it, you know, already some of the designs are made available for 24 hours, I think, in sort of the Western world, but then they're also being sold on WeChat in China. So there's a very savvy way to approach it. And I think that also ties in, you know, the designs are perhaps a bit younger, some of them skew towards younger consumers, and the way they're selling it is perhaps going to be, again, skewed towards a younger customer. So, I mean, I think that's what we're seeing quite a lot of luxury brands doing at the moment, is trying to kind of pique the interest of these younger consumers. And I think this will probably do that.
Monocle's fashion editor Jamie Waters ending this Monocle Daily, produced by Carlotta Ribello and Augustine Macellaria, researchers Daphne Carnesis and Marta Libri. Our studio manager was Kenya Scarlett. The Globalist is at 7 a.m. London time. Tomorrow, the Daily back at 2200 in London. For now, though, from me, Paul Osborne. Thanks for listening and goodbye.